Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
You're going to run into the same thing all the time. If you haven't invested anything, you're not going to put it together, because people that put up $1 million and the people that we have do put up a minimum of $1 million are not stupid. Most of the people that I work with, the investors I work with, own manufacturing companies. All of them own businesses. And so you're going to find that they're not bankers. They're not worried about ratios. They want to know that, number one, you're not going to walk away. The other thing they're worried about on experience, they're looking for somebody that has experience in management. Now, the guy you just talked about that started businesses does have management experience. And does have experience starting businesses, okay? That's a plus. What I worry about is we have people out there that have absolutely no management experience, have no business experience, and $0. And with those three things, as I said before, could I still put them together? Yes. Because I could go out, and again, what they do is they say, okay, this person's not putting up much money, or not putting anything up. So what we're going to say to you, Hamill, you're collecting a fee of a certain amount of money. You're going to have to leave it in the deal, or part of it in the deal. But a lot of times they'll say to me, I have to leave all of it in the deal. So I put the deal together for nothing. So when I get down to the end, I don't get paid. I have all these expenses. And when I get down to the end, I end up getting options on stock, because if you owed me $500,000 on a deal, or $250,000, whatever it is, if you paid me the money and I was taxable, I had the money that you gave me to pay the taxes on it. If I then just take ownership in your company, an ownership position, that's taxable. In other words, if I'm getting $250,000 or $500,000, I have to pay tax on that, even though I've received no money. The other thing that happens is, if you have limited business experience or management experience, they insist I stay in the deal personally as a consultant or something like chairman of the board, whatever happens. So what happens is, I can put it together if you have absolutely nothing. The problem is, I end up getting nothing. So it's a battle between me getting something out of doing this, because I'm not going to go out and do this and put these deals together just to end up with maybe a future on a company. I'm 72 now. I mean, where am I going to be?
Well, are you not going to bring in some grandma who's never run a business, doesn't know anything about it, and has put nothing in the deal? What's the point? But someone...
It's also stupid to think you can do that. It just doesn't happen. But nobody also is saying we're unfair here, because all I'm saying is, on one side, if they had absolutely nothing to bring to the table, I absolutely could put the deal together. So somewhere between absolutely, with them having nothing, and them having everything, is that where, that's where I am. In other words, nobody's going to cut them off because they only have a little bit of money, or they only have a little bit of experience. Whatever it happens to be, those people don't get cut off. Okay, those are the people I end up working with. We're not looking for perfection here. And the other thing is, on the business plan, there's two things that we have that we need, or I need, before we can go forward. In other words, they have to go out and buy this business and put a contract together. So there has to be a legitimate offer to purchase contract signed by both parties, mm-hmm. that I have to have a copy of and see as you're going along. The second thing is the business plan, which describes the business you're buying.
Right.
I can't go to the investors verbally and ask them to do something. So the business plan, as far as you might as well, you go right to the book. You go right to the library section on business plans, or you order a computer program on business plans.
Yeah, we put together a resource with thousands of business plans that they can model on all different topics.
Okay, well, it's not a big deal, but the thing is, keep in mind, if you're going out to borrow $10 million, make that business plan look like $10 million. When you're going out to buy a business, you're going to find almost every attorney will allow you to pay them at the close of escrow, so it's not something you have to take out of your cash hoard, okay, on the attorney. The CPA will do the same thing. He will wait till the close of escrow. So that's not something that you have to take out of your money.
If you were approaching a CPA, what would you say to that attorney or CPA in your own words to get him to ride along with the deal? How would you approach him if you called him up on the phone and said something?
I never call him up on the phone. I talk to him in person. Things don't call him up on the phone because they're going to turn you down. What you do is you go and talk to him about what you're doing. You describe the business that you end up buying. Okay? And you don't go in there ahead of time. You don't go in there and say, I'm going to get to it from the attorney before I even find one.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've worked with me and you've gotten it to the point where you're about to do something, what you do is you go in on the attorney because you're going to be going under a letter of intent, okay, in the beginning, which is a one-page deal that any idiot can draw up. You don't have to have an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the next week, 2 weeks, month, the attorneys are going to be getting together to put together a contract. I then see the contract as you go along, and then when it's done, I get a copy of that. At the same time, you have to put together a business plan. In other words, you have to put together a book, basically, or a package that describes the business you're buying.
Well, can they put the business plan as they're working with you, or do you want...
Yes, they can do it any time they want. If they don't know how to do it and they get intimidated, there are people out there that will put together business plans and charge them at the close of escrow. The contract has been the least problem. I mean, I haven't had anybody having problems with attorneys or CPAs.
Mm-hmm.
What I've had people problems with is people going out to get people to write the business plan. And I don't know why the person writing a business plan may have a master's degree or maybe he may be an English major.
Mm-hmm.
He or she might be an English major, as opposed to these other people who have doctorates and everything else. I mean, I don't know why anybody would be intimidated by somebody writing business plans.
Mm-hmm.
Business plan people are just very nice people that put information together.
Mm-hmm. If you were to tell Travis the specific order of things to do in relation to business plan, letter of intent, offer, contract, could you give me the chronological order of how things should happen?
Well, what you do is you sit down with the owner.
Mm-hmm.
And don't do this verbally from a distance or on the telephone. You sit down with him a few times and you negotiate the transaction. And then by the second or third or fourth, whatever meeting that you have, you make a letter of intent offer. And the letter of intent offer is nothing more than a summary of what you and the seller have agreed to. You've agreed to price, you agreed to terms, you agreed to the owner staying, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not in detail. It's not a binding contract. What you're trying to do is you're trying to get them to agree to certain things.
Mm-hmm. And then you have them sign it, or you both sign it.
You both sign it. It's not binding. And then you're going to think, my God, they're not going to stick with it because it's not a binding contract. And over the years I've been doing this, I haven't had anybody walk away from one of these.
They're very powerful because it's basically their word.
That's right. And so what happens is, and these people, you're going to find the chance of you running into a person that has a business making $1 million a year that doesn't have good word or isn't a good person.
They're good people.
I have not run into one.
Mm-hmm.
I have run into one I haven't gotten along with. They're all nice people. They're easy to get along with. And keep in mind, the people I'm working with and myself, when I come in, we have the most power of any person they meet because we have all cash. And when you can pay all cash, you're the one that talks. So the key thing is don't make a big thing out of it. I have just made a big thing out of it on the different conversations because I can't believe the problem we've had on business plans.
Okay, so you go in a few times, you get the letter of intent, then what?
Okay, so you're going through a due diligence period.
So do you tie it up before you get your due diligence, or is that in the letter of intent?
That's in the letter of intent. You're tying it up. They're taking it off the market.
Okay, so how long do you ask for?
60 days due diligence.
So 60 days. So in that letter of intent, he's going to take it off the market. You're going to have 60 days to do your due diligence.
That's right. And at the end, you go to contract. Now, there are situations when you're working with me. If you're working with me and you don't have a lot going for yourself, you're going to have to go to a contract sooner because I'm not going to sit around and work with you and then have the deal fall apart. There's nothing wrong with even going to contract in the beginning, but the letter of intent is easier to get signed.
Mm-hmm.
But you then go to contract, even if you have it at the end of the first week, you still have 60 days to the point where you have to put any money up. And somebody's going to say, well, God, we have a contract now. I need the money now. No, we don't put money up with letters of intent.
Or contracts.
Well, you do contract once you've gone through due diligence, but why should I put money up before I check things out?
But if you want to put up an early contract, is there money put up?
Not normally.
Okay.
They may ask for something toward the end, but usually what they do is they just forget about it. Okay. Depends on the broker more than the seller. But again, don't let this stuff get you. And the only reason I brought it up is when I first started working with these people, Michael, a couple of years ago, I had a certain thing in my mind. They're going to have problems with the following things. And that's not what happened. we ended up having problems with dumb things. In other words, I was out spending my life out buying companies, and I never had trouble with a business plan, information together. Now, years ago, a lot of times I'd went on a deal 20, 30 years ago, we'd have a complete package before we even started negotiating. Today, they don't do that. If a seller is selling it to you directly, they don't ever have anything put together. If they have an attorney or CPA that's going to get a listing on it, they do put it back together. The average business broker, if he gives you one sheet of paper, you're going to be lucky. Now, occasionally, you're going to run into a broker out there or somebody in merger and acquisition that has put a big package together, and what you ought to do is put that at the top of your pile, and you're going to say, well, there may be things wrong with it. Well, there may be, but one of the biggest things you have just gotten by is gathering all the basic information. Because when you go in, the less information you have by the time you go to the letter of intent, the more chance it's going to fall apart. Because the information you've gotten before you go to due diligence will be things that are going to screw up the deal because they held something back or they lied or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So just be careful.
So this guy, he's not going to need to spend $30,000 to $50,000 to get to the point of tying up a business.
I haven't had anybody put that much in.
No. And so, but let's say so he has that money left over to put. That's his skin in the game. Are you saying that could be enough under certain circumstances?
It depends on what he's trying to do, how risky it appears to be, how much experience he has. It's the package he brings to the table. The less he brings to the table, the more the reassurance you're going to want. It's just a logical thing. In other words, if he were doing this, I mean, since he has that much money, I'm sure he's smart enough to know if I want to go out and invest in something, these are the things I want.
Right.
And that's all I'm asking for. The people I work with are more reasonable than anybody else who you ever work with. They're very nice people. They're not hard asses. They don't nitpick. Because I don't work with people that nitpick. I don't work with people that I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I don't like them, I don't work with them.
Okay, let's see here. Here's an email from a guy. Okay, he writes to me, Michael, I just met with the president CEO of the largest manufacturer of target practice equipment in the U.S. Company revenues are $23 million. Company has enormous potential with pre-agreed lease programs with the U.S. military. If capital can be raised by the business, could take company revenues well in excess of $100 million annually. I met with the CFO, getting financials today. I, along with one of the co-founders, will be putting together a business plan. Sounds it. He said both company business plans should be ready by the beginning of the year. I'll have two potential buyout candidates. I'm very serious about this and sincerely hope Art can help us with the financing.
There's no trouble with the financing. It's not financing. We're bringing investors in.
Mm-hmm.
Investors mean you pay them a return. You don't have payments every month. And you end up owing the business being clear. Even if you put another $20 or $30 million into the company, we don't have loans sitting there. In other words, you're just paying returns to investors. Expanding rapidly, we don't have to pay them a return for maybe 2-3 years.
You know, I was listening to the course on financing again, and you know, the stuff you're telling me now is the same stuff you were talking about back then. Even
it not only has worked for years, it will continue to work for years. I always tell people, if you go to the moon or Mars or to some other planet, if there are people there, they'll be doing it the same way. I mean, the thing I found, even before you started getting all these people from all over the world, not one person in any other country that I've talked to through you or before you has ever told me about anything different in their country than it is here.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's the same. So,
well, on the part on financing, you were really excited about it when you were making the audio tapes, and this was back in, I think, 85, and you said, you know, I can't wait to see 15 years from now how the real estate community responds to this.
Well, that has really taken off. Everybody's copying the real estate part of it. I told you, the only difference between what I do and everybody else does, everybody goes out and tries to go public with companies using real estate for collateral. The only difference, I told you, is I'm the only one out there that I've seen that goes out and gets lines of credit as opposed to refining the real estate. That's just where I'm coming from. That's all. I feel very comfortable going to banks and getting credit lines. Here's another thing, this guy, tell him congratulations. And the only thing that matters on this, if what has to be put into this company, X number of $X million, makes sense financially, it will go together. So that's the key thing. If we can't make it work on our side, then I doubt if he's going to make it work unless he changes something. But if everything looks good going in, it's a great opportunity, Those are the ones we do. We have never turned down one that was even close, that was just a little distance away. Every one that we have turned down to date over all the years have been out in left field.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that they were bad, it's just that the arithmetic didn't make sense.
Right.
And if it doesn't make sense to me, I can't go to an investor and say, look, would you put up $1 million or $2 million or $5 million on this? They're going to say, are you crazy? If they can convince me, if they show me the good contracts that make sense, if they show business plans that make sense. And again, they'll know themselves. If they have any common sense at all, when they read the business plan back to themselves, they're going to say, this really makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really doing the right thing. And then the amount of money doesn't make any difference. We've always been oversubscribed. I mean, we've raised $50 million on deals where we only needed five.
Okay. Hello, Michael. Once again, I'd like to thank both Art and yourself on putting together all this valuable information. I am diligently plowing through all the course materials and also have begun to research my target prospects. A while back, you had said to keep the questions coming for Art. So if he doesn't mind, I sure would like to get his input. I have broken my questions down by categories, and although I have listed them all here, please feel free to break this up and tackle them as time permits, as you in Art see fit. I don't want to take Art or your time for granted or abuse this great privilege.
You know what's so great about this person that's writing or calling you? He represents 99.9% of the people I've worked with.
All right, prospecting. As I've mentioned previously, I fully expect that my list of prospects will come mainly from other provinces. He's in Canada,
right,
since there is little manufacturing here. As suggested, I will start my search for suitable business projects by looking through the manufacturer's directories to avoid the brokers. I'm trying to be ruthless as possible in targeting the best candidates to contact. Using the directory, it is simple to weed out all of those that have too many employees or have not been in business for 15-plus years or don't have enough sales to even be close to the $3 million profit per year. To narrow things down a little bit further, one, are there certain industries or types of manufacturing which you would generally prefer to look at or avoid altogether? And it gives examples. Manufacturing that sells mainly to government, manufacturers that serve the automotive industry, Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3 manufacturers, manufacturers that produce high-ticket items versus low-ticket items, example, ambulance vehicle manufacturing versus pressure washer manufacturers.
Let me take the first part first. Number one, I like working with people that break things down the way he breaks them down. He has a very organized mind. He'll do very well in business. I just want to tell you that. Let's take one that's stuck up, which is the automobile industry, whether it's level Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3. The thing you're always going to run into is you're going to run into an industry or a business where you have peaks and valleys. And when you are Tier 1, 2, or 3, I don't care what happens, because let's take the biggest supplier that General Motors has. It's in bankruptcy right now. It's a spinoff of GM. What these auto companies do is they give you as thin a margin as possible, and as soon as you can get used to it, maybe make a slim profit when you're there back the next year trying to cut your price down. So it is very tough to make a good profit in a business like that. And the other thing is you bring investors in. The problem is you're going to have years where you don't make enough money to get beyond the investors. In other words, there'll be enough cash flow maybe there to pay a return to the investors, and you and your family are going to be out on welfare or something. You have to stay away from the ones that have peaks and valleys. You have to stay away from ones where you're in industry that are continually working on you. It just like if you were buying a company that was selling to Walmart. I mean, you have to be crazy. Now, would your volume be good? Yes. Would they drive you nuts with their price cuts and the way they work? Yes, they would. And if you haven't worked with Walmart, you haven't lived. Number one, if you are a person as organized as this person is, appears to be, you should be doing is going after manufacturing companies where you are in control of your own destiny. In other words, you have proprietary products that your company is selling, that you're not a subcontractor for somebody else, because most companies out there, smaller companies, are subcontractors, which means if the people you're selling to do a good job during the year, you're going to have a good year. If they don't, it falls off. I mean, it's not only the economy, but it's depending on how good the job they're doing. If you're going to go after a business, say, that's making over $1 million, my suggestion is if you can find one that has proprietary products so that you can drive the sales organization or I can help you do it, what's going to happen is you're not going to have the peaks and valleys. You're not going to have the problems. You're not going to have to spend all your time in there nervously trying to get this thing to make money. So that's the basic thing you ought to go after instead of trying to come up with too many rules. In other words, go out and start with X number of dollars. You want to make $1 million, $2 million, say $3 million a year. Fine. Pick ones in that category. With our minimum, it's $1 million. We suggest at least $1.5 million so that by the time you get done analyzing the numbers, you're still above $1 million. Because we won't go in if it's under $1 million. So the main thing is to start with the number, the arithmetic, the $3 million net that he was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And what will happen is instead of only having two companies that sell to General Motors that make $2 million a year, you'll have thousands of companies in Canada and the U.S. that make $2, $3 million a year. So make it as broad as possible, get in there, and get your feet wet. Once you get in there and start to see what these businesses are like, even though you make a list of 10 things you think you're going to like, I'll make you a prediction, you'll end up buying a business that's different than anything you ever thought you'd do. Because you're going to get in there and say, boy, this really feels comfortable. I never thought of owning a toilet seat business, whatever it happened to be. Some
right.
ridiculous thing. I was actually thinking of porta potty. Somebody the other day asked me to help him buying a porta potty company.
A couple more things, and you may have answered some of it, but if you want to add anything. Do you look for manufacturers servicing more profitable niches and therefore commanding a higher profit margin over lower profit margin companies? For example, all other factors being equal, is a company making $3 million or $30 million in sales more valuable than a business making $2 million on $15 million in sales?
Well, the numbers you're talking about there are not bad, because normally in manufacturing, you're usually always going to find at least 10%. Okay. Once you get below that, you're basically in an area where you have a grocery store that has a 1% or 2% bottom line. Most of the ones I work on have 20, 30%. Okay? Let me give you an example. I own three printed circuit board companies. First one I bought in the Dallas area many years ago, I had a net profit on the business of about 50%. A few years later, I bought another one, and that thing was doing 30%. The last one I bought a few years ago was only doing 10. It's basically become a commodity because
right.
once it gets down to 10, and a lot of this starts to be done off, being done offshore, it makes it very difficult to go after those businesses. But again, what you do is you go out, get your feet wet, go out and visit a few businesses, and after a very few, it'll start to come to you as to what's really out there. It's not as complicated as it looks. It really isn't. Once you get out there, you're going to find basically almost every business is the same underneath. And so you look at a few things that are different, and then by the time you get into your second or third business, you're really going to find they're really boring. There's not a lot of excitement in these businesses because almost everything is the same. All you have to do is avoid the things I keep telling you to avoid.
All right, he asked, if I'm hoping to work with Arts Investors, should I even consider a business with less than $3 million in profit?
No, the figure is over. We've worked over $1 million. I have never gone back to the investors for the last 25 or 30 years with any business making under $1 million. And, okay, I have to keep that standard because, number one, if I start to deviate after all these years, it's going to make them nervous, I'm sure. I've never said anything, but I've kept that standard. Again, it's been more me than them. They've never said anything about it, but I can promise you, working with me, if the number ends up falling below $1 million, I will...
Do you have any thoughts on whether manufacturing companies with multiple facilities are good or bad? For example, some manufacturers have locations in two different cities or provinces.
It just makes it more difficult to manage it, but... Let's take Mexico. I was down in Mexico. I did not speak Spanish. By the time we finished after 15 years, we had 17 companies in almost every city, different cities in Mexico. I was not managing them hands-on. So what happens is, if you have a business in eastern Canada and another manufacturing plant in western Canada, and you're going to work hands-on, you're going to have a hard time getting back and forth every day. If you follow the rule, which is let somebody else continue to manage it, and if you, again, it's very simple to be an absentee owner, because there's going to be somebody there, either the owner's staying or the management that's getting paid a lot of money, and what they're going to do is manage this, and once you start to pay them the money you're going to pay them to run that, you're going to find that they don't call you, they don't bug you, you don't have to be in it on a day-to-day basis. And so with that in mind, I just want you to realize that running two is not going to be any difficult. More difficult than running one. I have been running multiple businesses since I started, 50 some years ago. I've never had one company at any one time, and I haven't had problems. And I don't consider myself that good a manager. I really don't. And go out, stick your toe in the water. If you're working with me on it, I can lead you through it and even help you with it, too. You'll laugh by the time we finish. And you said, it's another thing I worried about that isn't going to happen. All the years I taught seminars, I told everyone at the beginning of the seminar one thing. You've got a yellow sheet of paper. Put down the 50 things that are going to keep you from being successful in business. Take that piece of paper and put it in a desk drawer or a safe deposit box. When you close on your first business, take the yellow sheet out. And darn, you won't believe it. None of the 50 will happen, have happened. So all the reasons that all these people do not succeed in business is based on ideas they have that are absolutely lies. They're not true.
Okay, great. All right, here's the section, meeting the seller. When an owner receives my letter and decides he wants to talk to me about selling his business, what kind of information should I ask for? Does this depend on whether they are local or not? Since I'm not using a broker, if I find a manufacturer that is located outside my province, should I be looking for a certain amount of information before planning a four-hour flight and face-to-face visit? Is it reasonable to expect a certain details before committing to meet the owner?
Okay, well, the key things you're looking for with an owner. Number one, what is the price on it? Number two, what is the net profit? And so what you're asking for, before you fly across the country, you're asking for 3 years' financials, and then say 2005 to date. You also want a balance sheets of different years so you can see what the assets look like. Will the owner finance? These are things you're interested in. How long will the owner stay after the fact? These are things you can discuss before you go there. Now, you don't have to ask them for leases and inventory lists and all this other. Because what's going to happen is you may get there and find out you don't have a deal or that you can't put it together. And so if you ask for too much information, you're just wasting your time. Number two, you're wasting the other person's time too. So get as much as you can get at that point. Make sure the thing is going to work before you get there. In other words, if you think the thing's doing $2 million a year, and it's worth $8 million, and the guy wants $15. I can tell you, based on my experience, I've been doing this a long time. I never will fly a long distance or even drive a long distance to visit a business unless the price and the terms and stuff the owner's offering out is in the ballpark, because I've found out over the years, no matter how good you are, they don't change the price and other stuff that often. And the other thing is just take your time. Get as much information as possible. Check out the area. If it's Ottawa and you're not in Ottawa, then you're checking that area out. What the market is for that type product. These are a lot of things you can do. Now, the owners will provide you with some of it when you get there. If you did go through a broker, the thing to keep in mind, years ago, brokers used to put together a very extensive pack. Today, if you get one sheet of paper from the broker, you're lucky. So by the time you go to visit the seller, even though you have no broker involved, there's a good chance you'll have more information than you would have had if there's a broker involved. I don't know what the hell the brokers get paid for today.
All right, let's go to this section here, negotiations. If an owner is willing to stay past a certain length of time, is he usually offered a market value salary or benefits package, or perhaps you have to offer more to keep him on if he is used to large returns? Is this usually worthwhile to offer?
I don't know what the percentage has been in the last 10 years, but probably over 50% of our businesses, the owners have stayed. Now, these owners have all gotten cash, X number of million dollars when they closed out. A lot of them were making $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 that they were paying themselves in salaries plus other money they were taking out of the company. So they're making a couple million bucks a year. When you go in there, all you have to do basically is find out what the going rate is for somebody running a plant like you have. And 99 times out of 100, you'll find the owner will be happy with that. I mean, he's going to have $5, $10 million sitting in the bank. And he's not going to get hung up on this other, because what you're saying is, look, I want you to continue to run it. I'm going to pay a going rate. And you're going to say to yourself, my God, he's going to run this company. It's priced at $10 million, doing $2.5 million. I wonder what I'm going to end up paying. Well, you know what my range has been in the last few years?
What?
We're paying our managers $150,000 to $200,000 a year. Managers of manufacturing companies do very well. And again, the average person that's going to stay to work with you will think that's very good. The only thing you have to be careful of is a lot of them will say to you, I'd like to stay on, but I'd like to have an incentive program. I'd like to have part of the stock. When they do that, what I do is buy 90% of the stock of the company and let them keep 10. I don't want to go in there and pay for 100% of the stock then have them give them 10 back. So watch out for that trap.
Would Art ever encourage or discourage an owner from staying part-time once a business is sold? Perhaps an owner would rather just slow down instead of or retire completely.
Okay. In the last 15 years, the majority of the owners I've worked with are staying. The majority of the owners where I've helped people like people through you, Michael, they're staying also. In fact, you're even volunteering to do that, especially when you're cashing them out. You're cashing them out, you're taking all the risk away from them. They now can run this company. They get paid a good salary. They don't have the pressures that they had before of owning a company and providing financing and all sorts of things. And on every deal I have had in the last 10, 15, maybe 20 years now, I can't keep track. The former owners have done a much better job than I would have done.
Have you ever had a situation where the owner, you know, agreed to stay and maybe they stayed for a couple years and maybe something happened where they, I don't know, they got sick and you had to replace them? And
No, I have not had that problem yet. But what I would worry about is somebody just skipping out on me. And I wouldn't worry about that with an owner because I don't think an owner would do that. But I always worry about that with people I'm putting in management, how long they're going to stay. And that's why a lot of times we have forced them to buy in to the company. And what I'll do is the last one I had was a person that owned a multi-million dollar house in Saratoga.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to get him to put a second on his house, not payment or anything, just that he would forfeit a second for $100,000 if he didn't stay for 2 years.
Okay.
He would not do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going into something where I didn't have a good enough management team without him. So we never put the deal together.
So that's critical. You got to make sure that management stays and make sure that they're willing to put their money where their mouth is, where there's something to lose if they take off.
Well, that doesn't happen very often because most of the time there's already management in place in these larger companies.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly companies we're looking for, I'm looking for some owner that's never there. He's out playing golf and he flies in once a month for an hour. That's what you're looking for. But on the other hand, most people, when they're trying to use their so-called business common sense, they, I want a business where the guy has to work 80 hours a week to control this thing. That's stupid. If you're doing that, that means that there's two people that you should be hiring to replace you, maybe three people, and take it easy. The reason most people don't do it, they want more money out of the company, I would imagine. I've never really analyzed it.
Does Art usually hire the CPA and lawyer in the province or state of the seller or the buyer?
Yes. Number one, you want to make sure that the, say the attorney's drawing it up. There are different things that they do in different provinces or different states in the United States. And what you want to do is you want to be able to have your attorney draw up the agreement or analyze the agreement. Because a lot of times, the seller's attorney will draw up the agreement. I suggest against this because whoever draws up the contract wins. So you have the buyer has the attorney draw up the contract. He's from that province. He's from that state. He's using the same approach that everybody else does. They probably even know each other. So it makes it a lot better. And then also, you're going to need an attorney there. So why not hire an attorney now? And the other thing is the same thing with a CPA. We want somebody local. We want somebody that will stay on. We never use the CPA from the seller. Unless you're really crazy. Or the attorney. You have to have your own representation. And again, the majority of them, hell, almost every one of them that you'll run into, I don't care where you're on the planet, I will wait till the close of escrow, the collector fee.
Okay, very good. All right. I did have another question from a gentleman. He called me and I talked to him. He had questions specifically about the business plan. And I know we've talked about it before, but he's putting together a business plan, but he wanted to ask me, well, does it need to be a certain length? You know, what are some specifics about that business plan that Art feels over the years is something, besides from making sense, any specifics in this initial business plan? This is the official business plan, or can this thing be modified at a later date, or what?
It can be modified because that's what most people do. They put together a business plan. They then use it as a guide from year to year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they add to it. And they basically use it as a basic document in running their company.
Do you see business plans like big, thick books, or are these things generally pretty brief?
Yeah, well, it depends. It depends on how big the company is and how complicated it is. The business plans of startup businesses that are making no money are bigger than the ones that are making. What you have to do is you have to spell out in enough detail information on financials, on the industry, the company, the management, to to satisfy somebody.
What kind of information should be in there on the management? Like the name, obviously the name, how long they've been in there, any history on themselves?
Okay, what they're doing in that company.
Yeah.
With an organization chart, but they also want to know what their background is. And the more you spell out, the better. But the key thing is, if the person has common sense and they're going out to put together a business plan, what they have to say is, if I was going to invest $1 million in a company or $2 million, what am I looking for? And I don't care if they have $1 million. I mean, just take it from that standpoint.
Yeah.
In other words, these people want this much money, or they're not going to do it. Now, if you're buying a $10 million business, you better make sure your business plan looks like a $10 million business plan. If you haven't put these together and don't know how to do it, I suggest you hire somebody, just like you hire an attorney or CPA. Let them do it.
Mm-hmm.
Find somebody who does a professional job. And it's worth it.
All right, let me ask you this. In listening to the course, you were talking about real estate guarantees.
Right.
Explain to me, what is a real estate guarantee? Is that when your investors who put up the real estate want some kind of guarantee on the return?
Yeah.
Now, are you doing that or not?
No, here's what happened. Years ago, we came up with this as part of it, which was real estate guarantees. I'm not saying nobody's doing it now,
mm-hmm.
but what happened was owners would carry back financing on a business, but they wouldn't take the business as collateral. Okay, at that time, 25, 30 years ago, they wanted bank guarantees. That was at the time when banks were in trouble. Okay, so we came up and said, how would you like to have real estate to guarantee it? So we ended up with a number of people coming through every month for guarantees. We actually at one time had 5 groups of graduates from Los Angeles that were in that business. And the reason they got out was they thought that was stupid. They said, why would I provide guarantees to somebody to buy a business for a small fee when I can own the whole company? So after 6 months or so, all of them quit doing it because they found with what they had, they could buy a company. Let me tell you what happened with me. We were doing this, and we had a company doing nothing but this. I had a talk show at that time, a television program, half hour in San Jose. And we were taping 3 weeks, and I had the real estate commissioner on and the corporation commissioner on at the same time. We went out to lunch that day. I was explaining to them what I was doing, and they were insinuating that it might be illegal because when you start to use real estate for collateral, it becomes a security. So I hired 2 law firms, one from San Jose and one from San Francisco, paid them X number of dollars. They studied it for a couple of months, and they both came back with different answers.
Mm-hmm.
So we got out of that.
So you just stopped doing that?
The guarantee program works very well. We had a dentist, I remember, in Los Angeles that he just went in on a deal with you and didn't sign anything, he'd charge you $5,000 or $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
You had to guarantee something. His minimum fee was $30,000. From what I've read, back in the 30s, there was a lot of this going on. There were a lot of people and companies that were in the guarantee business, and there was a lot of fraud going on. So I don't know what happened between the 1930s and the 1990s.
One thing in the financing which I found really interesting was the receivables. When you look at a company and you look at the receivables and you look at the payables, talk about that, how you can finance the company by financing the receivables. Is that still done today?
Of course. In fact, if you go out and get involved in the ladies' garment or any garment industry, you're going to find a thing called factoring. They never have any receivables they really own. They take in $100,000 in receivables during the month. They go out and borrow against all of them instantly.
Is factoring done through banks or these separate companies?
Yes. All the people have to do is go to the Yellow Pages. And there's companies like Beneficial Finance and B of A. Everybody is financing financing receivables because of the rate they charge you. And, again, if you want to go out, I don't know what the minimum is now, but last time I checked it was a couple $100,000 that they wouldn't even work with you. They're looking for something larger. So one thing you ought to keep in mind when you're buying a company, if a company is factoring the receivables, there's something wrong. Most of the consulting jobs that I have done over the years on large companies, they have already gone to factoring because they were about to go down the tube. And it's easy to finance receivables. You probably almost do it the same day.
Well, how do the banks do their due diligence? I mean, if a company's about to go down the tubes and they're factoring those receivables, the bank can't figure out that there's a problem, or is the bank still going to be able to...
They're lending the money on the basis of the value, the strength of the receivables.
That's right. I remember you saying that.
Yeah, so...
Great thing to look at as a way to finance a company, or partially.
Forgetting about me and forgetting about using investors, it's a great thing. That's what's great about manufacturing. you buy a company for X number of $1 million, and there's X number of $1 million in there of free and clear accounts receivable that you can borrow against. Mm-hmm. Usually 80%. You also have all that equipment in there that you can either borrow 60-70% or do a sale and lease back, and you can basically borrow 100% of it. You can also take your inventory and usually borrow 50%. If you then, on top of that, can also get the owner to carry back some financing, you have just financed 100% of the value of that company. No investors, no nothing. You own all of it. That's what we did up until 25, 30 years ago.
Well, yeah, and the other thing that you were talking about, which blew me away, was if you can start negotiating better terms, you know, stretch it out to 90, 120, 6 months, and be able to use that money to make money. That was awesome.
Well, that's the biggest thing we used to run into all over the country, people questioning and challenging, saying, because we had people, and in fact it's in there, we tell them to go right, go back to somebody selling to you. Somebody is selling steel to you, and you're a steel fabricator, and say, look, I need to borrow $1 million. We're expanding our business. Now, if you're doing $10 million a year with them or 15, they'll do it. If they will not give you the money, if you owe them $1 million every month and they let you pay 1 month later, how much money have you just picked up?
Mm-hmm.
Picked up $1 million. No matter how you do it, it works. It's a standard thing that's done all over the world. In fact, when we first talked about it 30, 35, 40 years ago, all people looked at me like I was strange. Again, we have been doing this a long time, and it's just that a lot of people are not aware of this, because if you don't own a company, why would you be aware of it?
Yeah.
It's not something you read about in the paper.
Yeah.
Right. Nobody cares.
That's the end of this question and answer session with Art Hamill. I hope this has helped. And if you have any other questions, please feel free to email them to me, and I'll get them answered just as I have done on these. Make sure you listen to all the other recordings with Art Hamill, and thanks for listening. I started in the business buying and reselling hard-to-find seminars material. I had specialized in locating the very most expensive material, which was by a marketer named Jay Abraham. Well, I purchased from the original owners the original seminar material in the form of audio tapes, videotapes, books, and courses, and I resell them to people like you for pennies on the dollar. So someone may have paid $20,000 to attend the seminar and sit 5 days in an uncomfortable chair, but they all come home with the audio tapes. Well, I, from a personal need, didn't have the money, and I located hundreds of people who had these seminars, and I buy them and resell them to you. So what that means for you is you could get a $20,000 seminar for 10 to 20 cents on the dollar from me. If you go to hardtofindseminars.com, go to the product page and look for the section J. Abraham, and you'll see a multitude of seminars that I have available waiting for you. So if you want to take advantage and learn from the very best marketer in the world, J. Abraham, and if you want to do it for a lot less money, head on over to hardtofindseminars.com, and I'm sure I'll have something that will fit your budget.